Isaiah chapter 6 and 7, the sixth talk in a series on the book of Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on April 15, 2012, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at Isaiah's chapter 6 and 7. The first five chapters are introductory, and Isaiah has finished his introductory section. And in that section, he has argued that Israel has lost its way, that Israel has refused to recognize the care and provision that God has provided to the nation of Israel over an extended period of time. And they refused to recognize that, and as a result, as they look around at the world and all the scary things out there and all the ways in which they need to be cared and provided for, they're looking for other ways, other sources from which they can get that kind of care and provision. And there are many places that they have turned, but one of those places is they've turned to wealth as a means by which they can be saved, as a means by which they can be cared for and preserved. And so one of their activities has been to pursue the accumulation of wealth. And in so doing, they have neglected the needs of those in their midst who have difficulty caring for themselves, and in fact have even taken advantage of those people in their midst who can't have trouble taking care of themselves. So he points to the fact that they have neglected and even taken advantage of the widows and the orphans as evidence that they have lost their way. So, as a result of this, God's response to the fact that the nation of Israel has lost its way, is not faithful to their one true God, God is disciplining them. And there is more discipline yet to come. It has started, but there's more yet to come, that the nation of Israel is going to be, well, it's not clear exactly what's going to happen, but presumably attacked, conquered, taken away, and there will be a number of different steps in that process. But in the end, there will be a turning. That is to say, there will not be much of the nation of Israel left, but it will turn. It will turn to God. And that remnant then will become a holy remnant. And that holy remnant is going to have a glorious future, that Israel in the end will play a glorious role in human history. And that's what he has hinted at, kind of spelled out there in bits and pieces. And that's the way I'm putting it together at this point. Now he's going to talk about what appears to have been his initial experience when he became a prophet. I had said at the very beginning in chapter 1, where it talks about Isaiah having a vision, that term seems to be used in Isaiah and in some of the other prophets to mean an insight. So rather than a visual, ocular experience, it's having some kind of gaining perspective and gaining insight into what's going on and what will happen. But in chapter 6, he has an actual visual experience, a vision. And to my recollection, this is the only time that he has a visual experience that he calls a vision. So let's look at it, the first five verses. In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. Seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called out to another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the foundations of the thresholds trembled at the voice of him who called out, while the temple was filled with smoke. Then I said, Woe is me, for I am ruined, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. So the vision that he sees is that during the first year, or is during the year of King Uzziah's death. In chapter 1, it said that Isaiah's prophecy, a period of prophecy, begins with Uzziah, and it goes through Hezekiah. So this is at the beginning of his prophecy. As I mentioned before, this is a momentous time in the ancient Near East. The thing that makes this momentous is that there are three changes of power that are all happening at about the same time, within 2 or 3 years of each other. One was in Israel. The longtime king of Israel, and I'm forgetting what his name was, Jeroboam, I believe, died. And so there will be a change of leadership in Israel. And I think living in the kind of democracy that we live in, we're used to transitions of power. But when you live in a monarchy, that's a different matter. When there's a transition of power from one king to the next, things are kind of up in the air. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what kinds of policies are going to be enacted, whether there'll be a big change from what was happening before. You don't know what kind of power the king is going to be able to establish over his ministers, over the army, etc., etc. So it's always a bit dicey whenever there's a change in power in a monarchy. The other change of power that's happening is in Assyria. Tiglath-Pileser has become the new king in Assyria. Assyria has been a world power and has been for several decades. Assyria has been quite quiet and hasn't been very active in international affairs. But there's always the potential that that would happen again. And now Tiglath-Pileser becomes the king in Assyria, and there's the potential that Assyria would become a force to be reckoned with once again throughout the Middle East. And then Uzziah. Uzziah is in his last year of life. I've mentioned before, he was, according to Chronicles, he was a good king. The author of Chronicles describes him as a good king. During his reign, Judah was able to expand its boundaries to the largest that they had been since the time of the division of the kingdoms, going back to Rehoboam right after Solomon. And it's been quite prosperous. It's been prosperous for a number of years, about 3 or 4 decades now. But Uzziah is dying, and the question is, like in all of these situations, what will be the situation once he dies and a new king comes to the throne? How will he rule? Will the prosperity continue? And as I mentioned before, because of those three changes of leadership all happening at about the same time, there's this sense in the region that there's the potential for big change. So it's a little bit ominous kind of feeling. It's unsettled feeling. And I likened it to the Arab Spring, that it's a kind of phenomenon that's affecting the whole region. Everybody recognizes that it's significant, but nobody knows quite where things are headed. And that's the situation at the time of this vision. The vision that Isaiah sees is one in which God is sitting on a throne, and it seems to be happening in the temple. Now, that would be an appropriate place. The temple was the house of God, and in particular, the Ark of the Covenant, seems to have been designed to be either, and people argue as to whether it was the place where God sat or God's footstool. But either way, it's the place where God's presence is focused. And in all likelihood, it's that part of the temple in the Holy of Holies that Isaiah sees God sitting. But he's sitting on a throne, so he's in place as the sovereign king. And the temple is filled with his robe. So this is impressive clothing that he's wearing. And there are behind him, it's not clear whether it says stood above him, but it could be right behind him over his shoulder. We have seraphim. This is the only place in the Bible that the seraphim are mentioned. It's not clear what they are. But the word seraphim comes from the word to burn. So oftentimes they're referred to the burning ones. But that's about all that we know with respect to the seraphim. We don't know how many of them there were, but they've got wings. They've got three pairs of wings. They use one pair to cover their faces, one pair to cover their feet, and one pair to move them around, make them mobile. Now, the wings that are covering their faces and the wings that are covering their feet seem to be indicating reverence and humility before God. So it's covering their face, indicating humility. It's covering their feet, the feet being seen as the least clean part of one's body. And the seraphim are calling out to one another. And it's not clear. I imagine it that they're singing, but I don't know. But what they're saying is, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, and the whole earth is full of his glory." Holy, the word holy means set apart. And so what they're declaring three times, I think emphasizing this point, that God is holy, God is set apart, God is other. Now there's a question of in what respect is God set apart? In what respect is God other? And there are several things that could be pointed out. I mean, his power would be an obvious thing. His transcendence, any number of things could be listed. But I think, and I'm taking my cues from the Gospels here, I think that the thing that God is most proud of about himself is not his power, it's not his sovereign transcendence, but rather it's his moral character. And I say that because in God appearing as a human being, as God translating himself into humanity, the thing that's preserved in Jesus most clearly of God is the moral character. And so I suspect that that's what's being emphasized here, is that the seraphim are declaring the moral virtues, the moral goodness of God. And the whole earth is full of his glory. And I think that's still reflecting the same main virtue of God. So they're singing this, or saying it, and as a result, I think in conjunction with that, the whole temple is shaking. Certainly the foundation stones under the threshold are shaking as a result of the resounding voices. So it must have been a very impressive sight. And the temple was filled with smoke. Presumably this is smoke from the altar of incense. So the altar of incense, which is in the just outside of the Holy Holies, that's burning, and the smoke is filling the entire temple. And the smoke seems to be symbolic of God's presence. So God's presence is keenly felt in this whole scene. Isaiah's there and is witnessing this sight, And this, so I'm assuming that this is a vision. I don't know if Isaiah is actually in the temple, or if he's someplace else and he's in the vision, he's seeing the temple. That's not clear. But the only person that's present, as far as we know from the account, is Isaiah himself. He sees this, he hears this, and he responds. And his response is, I shouldn't be here. I'm inadequate to be here. He says, woe is me, for I am ruined. That's not an unusual response when someone is in the presence of God. Some places says that if you see God, you die. That there's this sense of an overwhelming inadequacy and disparity in the purity. Woe is me, for I am ruined, because I am a man of unclean lips. Why does he pick that out of all the things that he could say, I am a man of unclean lips? I think what he's doing is responding to the fact that the seraphim are declaring the moral goodness of God, and he is not up to doing that. He can't do that because he lacks that same kind of moral goodness. So I think that's why he's picked out the lips, unclean lips, as being what he's focusing on here. And then says, and I live among a people of unclean lips. So it's not only that he can't declare the moral goodness of God, but the people that he comes from, his people, the Israelites, they have the same problem. And yet, that's why they as a people were chosen by God. That's why God singled them out, has brought them along. That's why God has cared for them the way that he has. And what Isaiah is recognizing is both he and his people are not up to the task of declaring the goodness of God. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts, and he is inadequate to declare God's goodness. So, there's a response, verses 6 and 7. Then one of the seraphim flew to me with a burning coal in his hand, which he had taken from the altar with tongs. And he touched my mouth with it and said, behold, this has touched your lips, and your iniquity is taken away, and your sin is forgiven. So one of the seraphim that's behind God flies over with tongs, grabs coals, presumably from the altar of incense, and goes over to Isaiah and presses that coal against Isaiah's lips and burns him. It is, Noah and I were talking about this earlier this week. It's interesting how often burning comes up in Isaiah. We've seen it before, we'll see it again. Burning seems to be the means by which God purifies. I know that was an ancient concept. I can remember from the Odyssey, after Odysseus kills all of the suitors in the palace, that afterwards they clean the palace out and they clean it with fire and brimstone. I've always thought that was interesting. Fire purifies. And I think that that's the same notion is at play here, that fire, the seraphim, the burning ones, are agents of God's purification. And this one seraph comes and purifies Isaiah's lips with a coal. Interesting. I mean, if you just imagining that scenario, that's going to hurt. When that coal hits his lips, that's burning. It hurts. It's doing damage on the short run, but the end result is a purification. And I think that's kind of symbolic of what God's about here. That when it says that God is seated on the throne, in verse 5, it refers to him as the King, the Lord of hosts. When it refers to God as the Lord of hosts, it seems to me that the connotation is God in judgment. God with his armies. And I think that that's the scenario here. It's God seated on his throne, and this is God in judgment with his burning ones all standing behind him, ready to carry out that judgment, that burning. So Isaiah's lips are touched with the coal, and the seraph says, "Your iniquity is taken away, and your sin is forgiven." So now, presumably, Isaiah is prepared. He's ready now to declare the glory of God, the holiness of God. It goes on, verse 8, "Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, 'Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?' Then I said, 'Here am I, send me.' And he said, 'Go and tell this people, keep on listening, but do not perceive. Keep on looking, but do not understand. Render the hearts of this people insensitive, their ears dull and their eyes dim, lest they see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and return and be healed.' Then I said, 'Lord, how long?' And he answered, 'Until cities are devastated and without inhabitant, houses are without people, and the land is utterly desolate. The Lord has removed men far away, and the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land. Yet there will be a tenth portion in it, and it will again be subject to burning, like a terebinth or an oak, whose stump remains when it is felled. The holy seed is its stump.'" So, right after Isaiah's lips have been burned and the seraph has declared him to be free of iniquity, God says, "Who am I going to send? Who will go out for us?" Now, the "us" here, I'm assuming we've got a plural. I'm assuming that it's plural for the same reason that it's plural in Genesis chapter 1. And I take that to be the royal we, the plural of royalty. It's of royal of majesty, sometimes it's called. "Whom shall I send?" He doesn't say send to whom. He doesn't say send for what purpose. None of that is made explicit. But I think Isaiah knows, as soon as God says it, he knows what the task will be. That the task is going to be to make some kind of proclamation to the people of Israel. And so Isaiah eagerly volunteers for the task. The message that he's supposed to carry is a difficult one. This would not be a pleasant message to be the bearer of. It is for him to go to the people of Israel and say, "Keep on listening, but do not perceive. Keep on looking, but do not understand. Render the hearts of this people insensitive, their ears dull, and their eyes dim, lest they see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and return and be healed." So the message is that they are going to be made hard-hearted. They're going to be made so that they do not respond readily to the message that God has to say. Why would God want this to be communicated? Why would God even take this position, that he doesn't want them to turn? And I don't know the answer to that question, but my mind keeps going back to the little story that I've already mentioned with respect to J.K. Rowling, when she wrote about the death of one of the characters. She started to cry, and her husband came in and said, "Why are you crying?" And she said, "Because so-and-so just died." And he said, "Well, why don't you change it?" And she said, "Because the story demands it." Presumably, the story demands that it play out this way. And the only way that I can imagine the story demanding that it play out this way is that one of the things that God wants to be made apparent in history is his patience and his forgiveness and his mercy, the depth of those things. And in order for those to become manifested, he has to have that to which, with respect to which, he is patient and merciful and long-suffering. So presumably that's what's going on. That's what has to happen. That's what the story demands. Isaiah, understandably then, responds by saying, how long does this have to go on? How long will they be insensitive? How long will they be unresponsive? And God's response is, it's not going to happen until after the cities are devastated and without inhabitant, houses are without people, the land is utterly desolate, God has removed men far away, and the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land. So there is a lot that's going to take place, and those things are all creating a wasteland, a desolate place in Canaan, in Israel. It's all going to be made into a wasteland. And at least some are going to be removed far away. In fact, it's going to come down to the place that there is but a tenth portion of the population of Israel, I assume is what it means. Only a tenth of the people will survive. And it goes on and says, and it will again be subject to burning. So there's more burning yet to come after it's been reduced to a tenth. Then he likens it to an oak tree whose stump remains when it is felled. The holy seed is its stump. So we've got this tree, and I assume it's been destroyed by burning, because that's what's been talked about. The tree has fallen. It's been felled by the fire, I assume. All that remains is a stump in the ground where once stood a tree. But presumably then, from that stump will sprout a new Israel, the Israel from it, from what's left. The holy seed is its stump. Okay. So virtually completely destroyed, the people of Israel is completely destroyed, and only a sprout remains to come back and restore Israel. Okay, so that's the image, that's the vision that Isaiah saw. Now, in chapter 7, it jumps ahead several years. It jumps ahead probably 20 or 25 years. Verse 1, now it came about in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but could not conquer it. Then it was reported to the house of David, saying, the Arameans have camped in Ephraim. His heart and the hearts of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake with the wind. Here's the scenario. It is now Ahaz is now the king. He is the grandson of Uzziah, who died. It was the year of the death of Uzziah when Isaiah saw his vision. Ahaz is the king of Judah. Assyria has been resurrected as a world power. It has come back to life and is beginning to move west and threaten the nations, the kingdoms on the Levant, so in Palestine and Syria. The kings of Israel and Aram being essentially present-day Syria, the kings of those two kingdoms decide that they want to fight Assyria. They don't want to be conquered by Assyria and enslaved to Assyria. So they've decided they're going to make a stand. But the only way that they're going to be able to make a stand successfully is if they put together a big coalition, a big alliance of the kingdoms in the Eastern Mediterranean. So they need everybody that they can get to be on board with them. Ahaz has decided not to join that alliance. So Israel and Aram decided that they would go to war against Judah. And as we'll see later, they want to conquer Judah, depose Ahaz, and put another king on the throne who will be in favor of the alliance. Now, it's hard to put the chronology together here exactly. We don't know where in Ahaz's reign this happens exactly. But it would appear that this is towards the end of Ahaz's reign. Earlier in Ahaz's reign, just a few years before this, Aram fought against Judah and defeated them. Then a little bit later, Israel fought against Judah and defeated them. So apparently at this point in time, Ahaz has been defeated by both Aram and Israel separately. And now there's the potential of him being attacked by the alliance of the two. So it's for that reason that when he hears that they have united and they are camped in Ephraim and ready to come south towards Judah, it says, his heart and the hearts of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake with the wind. He's scared to death. I'll point out, when Israel defeated Judah, there were 200,000 women and children that were taken captive, taken to Israel. Well, let's read this. I'm going to read that section. It's in 2 Chronicles 16, I think. No, 28. 28. I was close. Yeah, I'll read the first 15 chapters, the first 15 verses of this chapter, starting with verse 1 of 28. Ahaz was 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. And he did not do right in the sight of the Lord, as David his father had done, but he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. He also made molten images for the Baals. Moreover, he burned incense in the valley of Ben-Hinnom, and burned his sons in fire, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had driven out before the sons of Israel. And he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places, on the hills, and under every green tree. So I'll just interject this. As opposed to Uzziah, who was basically a good king, his grandfather, Ahaz is a bad king and has given himself over to idol worship and the worship of many different gods. Apparently, he's scared. He is so scared that he has the policy of worshiping any god that comes along. Verse 5, wherefore the Lord his God delivered him into the hand of the king of Aram, and they defeated him and carried away from him a great number of captives and brought them to Damascus. And he was also delivered into the hand of the king of Israel, who inflicted him with heavy casualties. For Pekah, the son of Remaliah, slew in Judah 120,000 in one day, all valiant men, because they had forsaken the Lord God of their fathers. And Zikri, a mighty man of Ephraim, slew Maaseiah, the king's son, and Azrikam, the ruler of the house, and Elkanah, the second to the king. And the sons of Israel carried away captive of their brethren 200,000 women, sons, and daughters, and took also a great deal of spoil from them, and they brought the spoil to Samaria. But a prophet of the Lord was there, whose name was Oded, and he went out to meet the army which came to Samaria, and said to them, "Behold, because the Lord, the God of your fathers, was angry with Judah, he has delivered them into your hand, and you have slain them in a rage which has even reached heaven. And now you are proposing to subjugate for yourselves the people of Judah and Jerusalem for male and female slaves. Surely do you not have transgressions of your own against the Lord your God? Now therefore listen to me and return the captives whom you captured from your brothers, for the burning anger of the Lord is against you." Then some of the heads of the sons of Ephraim, Azariah, the son of Johanan, Berechiah, the son of Meshelemoth, Yehizekiah, the son of Shalom, and Amasa, the son of Hadlai, arose against those who were coming from the battle, and said to them, "You must not bring the captives in here, for you are proposing to bring upon us guilt against the Lord, adding to our sins and our guilt. For our guilt is great, so that his burning anger is against Israel." So the armed men left the captives and the spoil before the officers and all the assembly. Then the men who were designated by name arose, took the captives, and they clothed all their naked ones from the spoil, and they gave them clothes and sandals, fed them, and gave them drink, anointed them with oil, led all their feeble ones on donkeys, and brought them to Jericho, the city of palm trees, to their brothers. Then they returned to Samaria. So this was apparently something that had been experienced by Judah and Ahaz as king prior to the events that are being described here. So Ahaz is scared. He knows that God has allowed that defeat to happen. Why wouldn't God allow another defeat to happen? Verse 3. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, "Go out now to meet Ahaz, you and your son Shear-Jashub, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool, on the highway to the fuller's field, and say to him, 'Take care and be calm, have no fear, and do not be faint-hearted because of these two stubs of smoldering firebrands, on account of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram, and the son of Remaliah.' Because Aram with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah has planned evil against you, saying, 'Let us go up against Judah and terrorize it, and make for ourselves a breach in its walls, and set up the son of Tabael as king in the midst of it.' Thus says the Lord God, 'It shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass. For the head of Aram is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. Now within another 65 years, Ephraim will be shattered, so that it is no longer a people. And the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. If you will not believe, you surely shall not last.'" So God sends Isaiah out to meet Ahaz. He goes, he's supposed to go with his son. His son's name is Shear-Jashub, which means the remnant returns. I think that's right. The remnant shall return. All of Isaiah's kids have interesting names. I assume that the name comes from the what has already been mentioned earlier in the book, the introductory section, where one of the things that was emphasized is that there will remain a remnant of Israel, and that remnant will return to the land that was given to Israel by Abraham, and it will have that glorious future that we've talked about. And in recognition of that promise, apparently, Isaiah named one of his children, "The remnant shall return." That's a promise that I suspect is important to Isaiah. So he's supposed to take his son and meet Ahaz at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field. It's not clear where this was in Israel, in Jerusalem. It's in Jerusalem, but it's not clear where it was in Jerusalem. But in all likelihood, Ahaz was going out to the pool to examine the situation to see what can be done to secure their water supply. If there's going to be a siege, one of the most critical things is to make sure that you can provide your inhabitants with fresh water. And at this time, Jerusalem does not have a way to do that. It isn't until the time of Hezekiah that they really secure their source of water for a time of siege. But presumably that's what Ahaz is going out to do, is to check, to look at the water situation to see if something can be done to secure their water supply in case of a siege. Isaiah's words to him are, "Relax." He says, "Take care and be calm. Have no fear and do not be faint-hearted because of these two stubs of smoldering firebrands." The message from God is that God, that is the sovereign God, the God who is the master of history, the God is the God who raises up kings and puts down kings. He has said that Judah has nothing to fear. And these two formidable enemies, they have to look formidable to Ahaz. He's already been defeated by each of them. These two formidable-looking enemies are nothing but two stubs of smoldering firebrands. They're just the last glows of things that are going to go out. So Isaiah says, don't worry about them. What they are planning to do, and he tells Ahaz what they're planning to do. It's not, we don't know whether Ahaz has any knowledge of this in advance from another source, but the plan is, as I mentioned before, conquer Jerusalem, depose Ahaz, and replace him with a king who would be willing to enter into an alliance with Aram and with Israel. And he says, now within another 65 years, Ephraim will be shattered so that it is no longer a people. 65 years. If I were Ahaz and I heard this, I would be thinking, I'm dead by then. It doesn't matter. That's too late. I need salvation sooner than that. And the last thing that Isaiah says is, if you will not believe, you surely shall not last. That the only thing that will be preservative here is trust. And specifically, trust that God will do what he has said that he would do. Okay, the next section. Then the Lord spoke again to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Make it deep as Sheol or high as heaven. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. Then he said, listen now, O house of David. Is it too slight a thing for you to try the patience of men, that you will try the patience of my God as well? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel. He will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. For before the boy will know enough to refuse evil and choose good, the land whose two kings you dread will be forsaken. Now, this is a difficult passage, so think through it with me, and maybe you'll have improvements on what I've come up with. So, in response, after having told Ahaz that these two enemies that he fears so much are going to be gone within 65 years, and that he needs to trust God in that. Clearly, he's not responding in trust. And God says to him, ask for a sign. And you can ask for any sign. It can be as deep as Sheol or as high as heaven. And I take that to mean ask virtually any sign that you want. Ahaz's response is, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. There are a couple of things that are interesting to me here. One is the problem that Ahaz has is faithlessness. He can't trust God. So he's constantly in the search for another God or something else that will preserve him in this admittedly very precarious situation that he faces. So God says to him, trust me. And trust me, things will turn out fine. Well, that's the problem. Ahaz can't trust him. So God says, well, ask for a sign. The problem with asking for a sign, I mean, ask for a sign, ask for anything. I'm sure you've all played this game. What if you were given three wishes? What would you wish? You wish for what? A whole bunch of money and something else, and then your third wish is more wishes. If you're told, ask for a sign, ask for anything, why wouldn't Ahaz say, well, the only sign that'll satisfy me is impregnable walls going up all around Jerusalem or something like that? I don't know why he doesn't ask for a sign. He says his response is kind of a self-righteous response. It is, I don't test God. I don't want to test God. But for God to say, ask for a sign, is a curious thing in that A sign doesn't help faithlessness. Signs come in all kinds. Signs can be, they can be miracles. In some instances, there are miracles that are referred to as signs. Other times, it can be just something like piling up stones. After God has done something, pile up stones and it will be a sign to you. So it can just be something that helps you to remember. Nothing miraculous about it. But the problem with a sign, even the miraculous kind, is all it tells you is that God can do X. What Ahaz needs to know is that God will do X. It's God's commitment to him and to Israel. His willingness to respond. His willingness to do that which is good and right. And that's the very thing Ahaz can't trust. A sign won't help that. So Ahaz says, no, I won't test God. I'm not sure what Ahaz is thinking, why he turns down the sign. My best guess is that he's afraid that God is going to play gotcha. He's afraid that I'll ask for this sign, and God will accuse him of faithlessness or whatever. That's my best guess. I don't know why he won't ask for a sign. One of the commentators said that he doesn't ask for a sign because he's already decided that he is going to appeal to Assyria to come and rescue Judah, and that he doesn't want that to be shown to be a wrong course of action. I like my solution better. So he doesn't ask for a sign. So God says, I'm going to give one. Notice he says, listen now, O house of David. An interesting way to respond, refer to Ahaz, O house of David, hearkening back to the time of David, David being his faithful predecessor. It says, is it too slight a thing for you to try the patience of men that you will try the patience of my God as well? So this is Isaiah speaking for God. Is it too slight a thing for you to try the patience of men? Presumably this is try the patience of godly men. That is it too little for you to try the patience of those who are waiting for you to have a change of heart, to change direction, that now you try the patience of, and he says, my God as well. My God as opposed to your God, indicating that Ahaz is already going another direction. Ahaz has already turned his back on God. So God offers a sign. Since Ahaz wouldn't choose a sign, God offers one, and it is a curious sign. It says, behold a virgin. And I'll talk about the New Testament passage that refers to this next week. But behold a virgin. It's translated virgin here, but it's the Hebrew word just means maiden. It means, generally it refers to an unmarried maiden of marriageable age. There is a separate word for virgin in Hebrew. This is not that word. So behold, a maiden will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel. Emmanuel means God with us. So there's some young woman, presumably in Jerusalem, that's going to give birth to a son, and that son will be named God with us. It goes on to say, he will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. He will eat curds and honey. We'll see from later in the passage, and this has been hinted at earlier. Apparently, when there is a full population in Palestine, that milk can be hard to come by. And honey is hard to come by. But when the population is thinned out significantly, both of those commodities are available in much greater quantities. And if you have more milk than you know what to do with, you can convert it into curds. So curd seems to indicate more than enough milk to go around. And if there's honey to eat, there's more than enough honey to go around. So it's all suggesting a rapid drop in the population of the area. So he will eat curds and honey at the time he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. Presumably what's in view here is at the time that he develops a moral conscience. And the question is, when does that happen? There are some that have suggested that this is happening very early. We're talking 5 or 6. I think it's more likely that we're talking about reaching adulthood in the ancient world. So we're talking like 13 or 14 or 15. But it's a short, relatively short period of time. It's a lot less than the 65 years that was indicated earlier. So he will be eating curds and honey at the time that he knows enough to refuse evil and choose good. For before the boy will know enough to refuse evil and choose good, the land whose two kings you dread will be forsaken. So now this is a much shorter time before both Aram and Israel have been forsaken. So the scenario seems to be, the sign that God is giving is the kind of sign that doesn't help faithlessness a bit. There is going to be a boy born in your midst. His name is going to be Emmanuel, and he's going to be walking around, kicking the soccer ball around Jerusalem, and you'll see him from time to time. And when you see him, he will be a reminder of what God had said, God is with us. And he'll be a little clock ticking away, that as he grows up, as the years pass by, that you were told that when he reaches this age, and we'll say 13, that those two kingdoms that you feared so much are going to be gone. They'll be history. That doesn't help faithlessness at all, but to the faithful, that would be very encouraging, a very encouraging reminder of what God had promised. The next section. The Lord will bring on you, on your people, and on your father's house such days as have never come since the day that Ephraim separated from Judah, the king of Syria. That Ephraim separated from Judah, the king of Assyria. And it will come about in that day that the Lord will whistle for the fly that is in the remotest part of the rivers of Egypt and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. And they will all come and settle on the steep ravines, on the ledges of the cliffs, on all the thorn bushes, and on all the watering places. In that day, the Lord will shave with a razor hired from regions beyond the Euphrates, that is, with the king of Assyria, the head and the hair of the legs, and it will also remove the beard. So what's being predicted here is a time of affliction like Judah has never seen since the separation of Judah from Israel. And the agent of that will be primarily the king of Assyria, but it goes on to say that God's going to whistle and the flies is going to be like flies coming and bees coming. The fly suggesting Egypt and the bee suggesting Assyria, and they are going to be everywhere. They're going to be in the ravines, they're going to be on every cliff, they're going to be absolutely everywhere. So Assyria and Egypt are just going to descend on Judah. And the Lord will shave with a razor hired from regions beyond the Euphrates. So their hair is all going to be shaved off, including the hair of the head, the legs, and also the beard. And in the ancient world, in particular, having your beard shaved off is being shamed. So they are going to be humiliated by Assyria and by Egypt. And the last section, now it will come about in that day that a man may keep alive a heifer and a pair of sheep, and it will happen that because of the abundance of milk produced, he will eat curds, for everyone that is left within the land will eat curds and honey. And it will come about in that day that every place where there used to be 1,000 vines valued at 1,000 shekels of silver will become briars and thorns. People will come there with bows and arrows because all the land will be briars and thorns. And as for all the hills which used to be cultivated with the hoe, you will not go there for fear of briars and thorns, but they will become a place for pasturing oxen and for sheep to trample. So the scenario seems to be that those who are able to, that have a heifer and a pair of sheep, are going to have an abundance of pasture for that, because the land is going to be emptied out. And so everyone will be eating curds and honey because of the abundance of those foods and because of the few people that are in the area. And all the agricultural land, the vineyards, are going to be trampled. And there'll just be thorns and briars, and people will come and hunt there rather than harvesting crops. This is all reminiscent of the image that he had used in chapter 5 of the vineyard, the beloved vineyard that God had planted and cultivated and taken care of, that all describing Israel and Judah. But because of its rebelliousness, he withdrew his care and tore down the hedges, tore down the wall, and it was all trampled underfoot. And this seems to be hearkening back to that. All of their vineyards are going to be dismantled and trampled underfoot. Okay, a couple of things in conclusion. The first one, with respect to chapter 6, it has to be, from the accounts that we have of instances where people have seen God, it has to be a humbling and amazing experience. John, in the first chapter of John, says that no man has seen God. I think in that context, what it has to be referring to is no one has seen God in his transcendent glory. Why not? Because that is impossible. Just like if we use the Jack's author analogy, no character in a story can see the author. To the extent that they can see the author, it's only to that extent that the author has made himself a part of the story, then he can be seen. I suspect that something similar is at play in what John is saying, that in his transcendent glory, no man could ever see God. But there are instances where God has reached into the story and made himself visible, made himself seen. And this is one of those times. So Isaiah is seeing God as God has revealed himself in history, in a time and place. And I've tried to think about what it would be like to see God. And I can only assume, especially given this account, it's got to be clarifying, that there's something about seeing God that is very clarifying for Isaiah, that he sees things much more clearly and in perspective. I can think of times when I heard about someone that I had never met and had conjured up an impression of what that person was like. And in some instances, it was a negative image of that person. And then I met that person, and all of that negative part was dispelled. Have you ever had that kind of experience? Or it can also happen, someone that you know very well, and you hear that they've done something that surprises you, something that you have a difficult time accounting for, and your mind can kind of run with that and become suspicious, and you develop this whole network of suspicions around, given the clues that you've heard, and you put them in the most negative light. And the whole time that you're building up these suspicions, there's this sense that this is strange. This is not in keeping with the person I know, but this seems to be what's happening. But then you meet them face to face and talk to them, and all of that can be dispelled. Have you had that kind of experience? I suspect that seeing God is that kind of thing, that it is very clarifying, that whatever images you're conjuring up that are off base, those get quickly reoriented when you actually see him face to face. And that seems to be what has happened with Isaiah. It would be wonderful if we could have that experience, if there's some way that you could set up that kind of experience, but that has not been given to us. But what has been given to us is a record of that kind of thing. And it seems to me that that's the kind of role that a book like Isaiah can play in our lives, is reorienting, clarifying of who God is and what he's about and what kind of a role he plays in our lives. The other thing I want to talk just briefly about is I started thinking about the sign that God asked Ahaz to ask for, and Ahaz declined. And I was thinking, it is interesting to me that Jesus' biggest following was when he was multiplying loaves and when he was performing the miracles, healing people, and that sort of thing. And you would think that seeing those things would strengthen one's faith. I've often thought, if we could just live at that time and see those things, then it'd be easy to believe. But as I mentioned earlier, I think at the heart of belief is not seeing the power, but rather it's trusting the person. And that's a different matter. Signs and miracles are not particularly trust-building in the character of God. And yet that's what has to happen. God, I'm more and more convinced of this, God has chosen to step back in history. There have been times when God has stepped forward and been overt in history. But for most of history, he steps back and acts in an indirect way in reality around us. And what we are asked to do is to believe, even given that God has stepped back, and trust that he has our best interests in mind, and that he is trustworthy, he does love us, and he will do what's right by us. And miracles don't help in that. It's a matter of coming to know who that God is and trusting him to be looking out for us and caring for us the way that he has promised to do. I am struck by the scenario, I should have looked this up and refreshed my memory, but Elijah, isn't it Elijah? He goes off, and it was after he had performed the miracle on Mount Carmel, where he brought down fire from heaven to consume the offerings that were there. So it was and then he killed all the prophets to Baal. But then he goes away, and he seems to be disappointed because more wasn't done. I don't remember exactly that the king of Israel, I think he would like to have had him killed and replaced. But God comes to Elijah, but first there's the earthquake, and then there's the thunder and lightning and the wind. I think it's those three things. But God wasn't in any of those. God was in the still small voice. And I think that that's really our experience of reality, that there's lots of thunder and lightning out there, but where is God really at work? Where do we really see him? Where do we really interact with him? And it's that still small voice in the mundane that we're interacting with him. And that's where our faith comes into play, that what God's doing here, it may not look all that impressive. It may not look like it's going in the right direction. But in fact, it is. That when we look at the track record and what God has done and the ways that he's shown that he loves us, we can trust that he does love us and have our interests in mind. And he is doing what's best for us. Okay. We'll just take time for a couple of questions or comments. I didn't leave much time.
David, I was just a little confused. So basically his sign is saying, his sign that everything's going to be okay, is basically saying it's going to be okay, those two enemies are going to be gone, but there's going to be a more powerful enemy that's going to just cream you. So that's the good news. And then in verse 22, when it's talking
about... you'll be dead by then.
But in verse 22, when then it's talking about there'll be an abundance of curds and honey, and that it refers to a he. Is that he? Is that the same?
I think that's the man who has
the heifer.
Kept alive a heifer and a pair of sheep.
But is that at the same time then that the boy, Emmanuel, will be eating curds and honey? So in a sense... I don't know how long it is between.
It's possible that it's the same time, or it could be after, in so far as Emmanuel will be eating curds and honey because there's been a decrease in the population, but there will probably be a further decrease in population after that.
Or is it referring to that decrease in population as the Assyrians? It's all the same. And so before the child is like 13 or whatever, before he's making moral choices, the two enemies, Israel will be gone.
And Aram will be gone.
Will be gone. But then it's not very long after that then that
Judah will be devastated.
Yeah, right. Do you know how many years?
I think it's about 20 years between. I think it's 720 or 721 is when Assyria comes and takes and conquers Israel and takes a large part of the population away. And at that time, they also attack Judah, if I'm not mistaken, and devastate quite a bit of Judah. But they come back later. And I think it's about 701 or 700 that they come back, destroy all of Judah except for Jerusalem.
And do you know... a lot of through Isaiah, I mean, he has kids that have names that mean something.
Yes.
Does the language allow for this young woman being Isaiah's wife and that it's Isaiah's child?
That's what most commentators go with, is that Emmanuel is also his son. And that could be.
Just a quick detail in 6:6. He holds the coal in his hand to Isaiah's lips, but he took it out, he picked it up with tongs. Now, was that coal holy unto the Lord, and the seraphim was not allowed to touch it at that point? I mean, at what point does he, and why does he drop the tongs and then hold it in his hand? Is that why they're called the burners? I don't get that. It's an odd little detail that jumps out at me.
I don't know. I don't know.
And back to her question on the sign, when you said God would play gotcha, you meant that the king would ask for a sign and God would plainly give it to him and he would be stuck. And God would say, well, now you know, and his faithlessness would be exposed.
Right. I mean, that one of the commentators took it to be that he wanted... he wanted to ally himself with Assyria, which he later does. And that the commentator is speculating that he had already decided he wanted to do that at this point. So he doesn't want a sign because that would make it harder for him to justify, whether it's to himself or his advisors, it would make it harder for him to justify going ahead with his plan.
Even the demons believe and tremble. So at a certain level... he knew that God was a God.
I think so. I think he does believe that God is a God. But he seems to be the kind of person that he wants to worship all the gods to try to draw as much security as he possibly can. Because we'll see that he ends up he worships the god of Syria. He ends up worshiping the god of Assyria. So he's willing to worship all of them. But I think he does believe that Yahweh is a God. What he's not convinced of is that Yahweh's either able to defend Judah or willing to defend Judah?
Just a little curiosity about the virgin and birth.
Mm-hmm.
How did that become prophecy, sort of used in by Christendom for... and I see that even when I'm looking down here, it reverts back to Luke 1:31 mm-hmm. as relating to this somehow.
Yeah. I'll talk about that next week. It's complicated, but it's an interesting little thing to look at. So we'll look at that next week. Okay. Thanks.